Volkswagen is introducing a new car, a design that will get 170 miles per gallon. That's a level of fuel efficiency never seen before in any car. But as NPR's Robert Krowich says, VW, prepare to be humbled.
No question, 170 miles per gallon. That's a huge engineering achievement. But as the blues singer Muddy Waters could tell those oh-so-proud German engineers,
sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
You can get even better mileage from, of all things, a bee.
Sail on.
We're talking here about an ordinary honeybee.
Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
Because when it comes to miles per gallon, bees turn out to be better than the latest Volkswagen or better than any car ever made. I learned that from Steve Buckman. He studies bees at the University of Arizona.
If you could introduce me as the international coordinator for the Pollinator Partnership.
I can do that, but I want to make sure, since you like bees so much, that you don't hate cars, because that would make it unfair.
No, I like cars.
Okay, good. So it's your scientific contention, then, that a bee can take a unit of fuel and do more with it than a car.
Yeah, exactly. It's the ultimate hybrid mini vehicle.
Partly because muscles, all animal muscles, are superb converters of energy. And you know, cars, even the best cars, how they get warm when the engine's on? Well, when you feel that warmth on the hood,
I mean, that is losing a huge, huge amount of heat. But in the case of the bee, this is not losing nearly as much. So far more of the fuel is getting into the propulsion to beat those wings and drive the bee through the air.
Oh, so they're pretty efficient.
So pretty efficient.
Sail on.
Okay, so to calculate what we're going to call bee miles per gallon, what I gather you do is you take a bee and you give it all the honey it could possibly drink, and then you attach it to some kind of a pole?
Well, yeah, you can actually tether a bee onto a piece of wood or a little wire, and then...
You don't think it's hurting the bee particularly, is
it? No.
And how do you get it to fly?
Sometimes you need to blow on them a little bit, so give them a little experience of wind in their hair, you know?
Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
So, this tethered bee is going round and round and round a device which measures the distance as the bee flies. So, you watch.
And let them fly till they run out of gas, till they can't fly anymore.
But now you know how far a bee can go on a tummy's worth of fuel, so you can multiply and figure out how far it goes on a gallon. And it turns out bees are good.
Bees are amazing creatures.
So if you were to give a bee a whole gallon of honey, how many miles could that bee fly?
4,704,280 miles per gallon.
Hey!
Did you just say 4,704,280 miles per gallon?
Yes, I did. Try that in the home automobile.
I hear a lot of buzzing.
Oh, come on. Aren't you just playing with the numbers here? Because is it the bee? Isn't it that the bee is very little? Or is it really that the bee is that good?
We are playing with the numbers a little bit in terms of the scaling factors, but honeybees are far more efficient than any kind of internal combustion engine that, you know, humankind has ever devised. So if you want to think in terms of miles per gallon, no denying it. We've got almost 5 million miles per gallon. Pretty darn impressive.
And we just thought the folks at Volkswagen should know. Robert Krowich, NPR News.
This is NPR News. With snow blanketing much of the country, the topic of global warming has become the butt of jokes. Climate skeptics built an igloo in Washington, D.C. during last week's storm and dedicated it to former Vice President Al Gore, who's become the public face of climate change. There was also a YouTube video called 12 Inches of Global Warming that showed snowplows driving through a blizzard. For scientists who study the climate, it's all a bit much. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, they're trying to dig out.
Snowed in Washington is where much of the political debate over climate change happens, so it did not go unnoticed when a Washington think tank that advocates climate action had to postpone a climate meeting last week because of inclement weather. That kind of irony isn't lost on climate scientists. Most don't see a contradiction between a warming world and lots of snow. Here's Kevin Trenberth, a prominent climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado.
The fact that the oceans are warmer now than they were, say, 30 years ago, means there's about, on average, 4% more water vapor lurking around over the oceans than there was, say, in the 1970s.
Warmer water means more water vapor rises up into the air, and what goes up must come down.
So one of the consequences of a warming ocean near a coastline like the East Coast and Washington, D.C., for instance, is that you can get dumped on with more snow, partly as a consequence of global warming.
And Trenberth notes that you don't need very cold temperatures to get big snow. In fact, when the mercury drops too low, it may be too cold to snow. There's something else fiddling with the weather this year, a strong El Niño. That's the weather pattern that every few years raises itself up out of the western Pacific Ocean and blows east to the Americas. It brings heavy rains and storms to California and the south and southeast. It also pushes high-altitude jet streams farther south, which brings colder air with them. Trenberth also says El Niño can lock in weather patterns like a meteorological highway so that storms keep coming down the same track. True, those storms have been big ones, record breakers. But meteorologist Jeff Masters with the website Weather Underground says it's average temperatures, not snowfall, that really measure climate change.
Because if it's cold enough to snow, you will get snow. We still have winter, even though the temperatures have warmed on average, about 1 degree Fahrenheit over the past 100 years.
Masters says that 1 degree average warming is not enough to eliminate winter or storms. A storm is part of what scientists classify as weather. Weather is largely influenced by local conditions and changes week to week. It's fickle, fraught with wild ups and downs. Climate is the long-term trend of atmospheric conditions across large regions, even the whole planet. Changes in climate are slow and measured in decades, not weeks. Masters and most climate scientists say a warming climate would be expected to affect the weather, sometimes drastically, but exactly where and when is hard to predict.
In that kind of a climate, you'll have more frequent extreme events, heat waves and so on. But again, none of those individual events is proof in itself that the climate is changing.
Climate scientists say they can't prove any single weather event is due to climate change. Thus, they say Katrina or the heat wave in Vancouver that's dogging the Olympics isn't proof that climate change is happening, nor can eastern and southern snowstorms prove that it's not. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Today, a remote coastline in India where climate change is a serious issue for people living there. They are directly threatened by the changes in the world around them. Their land is being swallowed up by a rising sea. NPR's Philip Reeves visits an island on the edge of the Bay of Bengal. And it's not just any island.
The mid-morning ferry from the mainland has just pulled in. Hundreds of passengers jostle with each other as they stream down the jetty. They're arriving from India's east coast after a short journey across the soupy, flat waters of a giant estuary. The island's quayside stallholders are waiting eagerly. They're cranking on hand presses, turning sugarcane into juice. A man sits on a mat surrounded by exotic shells, advertising his wares by blowing on a conch. This is a good place to do business. Thousands come here to Saga Island every day. Saga is part of the Sundarbans, a low-lying archipelago that straddles India and Bangladesh. It's wrapped in the world's largest block of mangrove forest and fans out into the Bay of Bengal. Amid this spray of islands, mudflats and swampy jungle lives the endangered Royal Bengal tiger, an amazing animal that drinks salt water, swims for miles, and occasionally kills an inhabitant. The delta is home, too, to man-eating crocodiles. It's also home to a lot of people, more than 4 million just on the Indian side. They include Varun Pike. Pike is a tough, wiry-looking farmer in his 50s. He's spent his life on Saga Island. Today, he's standing on a long, wide beach, pointing a finger out to sea.
2 kilos. 3 kilometers.
A mile or two out, beneath the grey waves, lies most of his land, he says. Pike's surrounded by the rubble of a giant brick wall. Large, broken lumps of brickwork are scattered along the beach in a straight line, as far as the eye can see. This is the remains of a barrier built by the authorities. A cyclone ripped down the wall a few years back. Pike now only has 2 acres close by the beach. His land's recently been flooded several times. He thinks it's only a matter of time before it's completely swallowed up.
This year all my land will be gone because the barrier is gone.
Durga Pal lives here too. She's small and middle-aged and weathered by nearly half a century of island life. She says her family's also lost most of its land.
Our grandparents and our parents, they all used to stay here. And we had a lot of wealth and a lot of land before this. But now we are left with very little land and very little money to survive on.
Pal says many people in her village have left.
Happy. Half the community's left because of the sea coming in. What will you do if the sea does come onto your last remaining piece of land? What will you do, sir?
She's not sure, but she and her neighbours are sure about why the waters are devouring their land.
Ah, Bhagwan.
Bhagwan is zimmewar hai. The God is responsible for it.
Gods and gurus play a big part in the life of this island. Saga Island stands at the point where the Ganges, Hinduism's holiest river, flows into the sea. Once a year, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims gather here for one of Hinduism's largest religious festivals. Most of the island's small thatched mud homes have their own shrine. There are hundreds of temples. At the best known of these temples, a group of women is worshipping. Baba Jitendra Das is one of its priests. He says Hindus come here from all over the world.
England ke aate hain, Germany ke aate hain,
Japan. The temple is about 300 yards from the beach. Das says when it was first built, it was situated a couple of miles away, on land now underwater.
Teen mandir samudra mein chala gaya.
Before this, there were 3 temples which were destroyed by the water, and this is the 4th temple which was built.
The islands of the Sundarbans have been shrinking and shifting for centuries, partly because of silt and subsidence. But the rise in water levels began to accelerate a few years ago.
Since the year 2000, the trend is actually steeper, upward steeper.
Pranabis Sanyal is a member of India's Coastal Zone Management Authority. Saga Island is less than 30 kilometres long. Sanyal says in the last 40 years it's shrunk by 25 square kilometres. He's been studying the Sundarbans for most of his professional life. So has oceanographer Sugata Hazra.
For the last 20, 30 years, we are getting more cyclones and we are losing land to the sea. This is the reality.
Hazra's worried about a recent surge in scepticism about climate change, fueled by widely publicized mistakes made by the UN's climate change panel, including the prediction that the Himalayan glaciers could be gone in 25 years. Hazra concedes climate change scientists do make mistakes and should correct them, but he adds,
if they lose the battle to this lobby who are trying to discredit the science of climate change, who are trying to defame the scientists, the world lose the battle.
Hazra says sea levels in the Sundarbans are rising at a rate well above the global average. He says thousands of families have already been displaced, becoming climate change refugees. Hazra says the causes are many and complex, but he's in no doubt human beings are playing a part.
Look, it is definitely a factor. It is not that it is a possibility. It is one of the most important factors is the man-made climate change.
The islanders themselves are not so certain. A group gathers in a farmyard to tell the story of a tiny island nearby. That island completely disappeared beneath the waves 20 years ago. Radharani Jana and her family used to live there and had to move here.
Our house and our farms all got submerged.
The families worried that one day the rising seas will compel them to move again. They too see this as the work of the gods rather than people.
Has anybody here heard of global warming? Man-made global warming? Has anybody in this group heard of that?
No.
We ask again using different words. Again, there are blank faces. The islanders of the Sundarbans, the people in the front line of the rising seas, know much about the dangers of tigers and crocodiles, but little of the damage mankind is doing to their world. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
We're going to hear now from someone who spent years engaged at the highest levels with Iran about its nuclear program. Mohammad El-Baradei stepped down in December after 12 years as head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. He joins us from Vienna. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Melissa, for having me.
We heard Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today saying of Iran, we don't want to be engaging while they are building their bomb, saying that leaves the international community little choice but more sanctions. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure they are building a bomb. There is a concern, Melissa, that their program needs to be clarified. There are, as you know, concerns that they have been doing some studies on how to develop a weapon. We are not sure this is the case, but Iran needs to engage substantively with the international community to clarify this concern. It's a very frustrating situation, Melissa, frankly, because it has been on again, off again for many, many years. When the Iranians were ready to talk, the Bush administration was not ready to talk, and there were certain conditions Iran has to fulfill before they start the dialogue. When Barack Obama is now ready to talk to them, they are into certain domestic hype of some sort inside Iran, and they are not in a position to put their act together.
You said that you do not believe, you're not convinced that Iran is building or has intentions to build a nuclear bomb. Iran has certainly concealed its intentions in the past. I mean, it had a whole uranium enrichment facility that was not disclosed until this past fall, which surprised everyone. What makes you so convinced that their intentions are not exactly that, to build a nuclear weapon?
I'm not convinced that they're entirely clean, Melissa, but as I said, I'm not panicky because I haven't seen any concrete evidence that Iran is actually building a nuclear weapon. But the solution is to try to see how to get Iran to turn around and make good in what they say, that this is a program for peaceful purposes. There's a lot of psychology there. It's at the end of the day, I believe that Iran wants using the nuclear program as a mean to an end, which is to recognize Iran as a regional power. Whether they are doing it the right way, whether the West is responding the right way, there is a lot to be said about that.
Dr. El-Baradei, you have been accused by your critics as having been too soft on Iran at the IAEA. Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that you muddied the message to Iran. We're really engaging more in diplomacy than in the proper mission of nuclear safeguarding and verification. I wonder, as you look back on your time with the agency, did you do enough, do you think? Did you pursue the right strategy to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power?
I think I did, Melissa, everything I can within the authority I have. I don't have God's authority. I have a very limited authority. And, you know, you cannot just go and give them order. You have to understand where they are coming from, and you have to also try to provide them with incentive. And what the Bush administration did not like to hear, that they need to reach out to Iran without precondition. This was, for them, a heresy. Well, if you see what Barack Obama is doing now, is what I was advising at the time, that I didn't see Iran coming to the table with condition attached to the negotiation. Well, the Obama administration understood that right away, and they are offering Iran negotiation without precondition.
That open-hand policy that you're describing under President Obama, though, does seem to be met, again, with further intransigence and, indeed, provocation on the part of the Iranians. So what are the signs to you that that is, in fact, a policy that will bear fruit?
I think eventually it will bear fruit, Melissa. I could be wrong, but I don't see any other policy. I mean, you can have pressure. I'm not questioning that. But you have always, at all time, to maintain the dialogue. We have seen in North Korea, which is a perfect example, when the dialogue stopped during the beginning of the Bush administration, North Korea walked out of the NPT and then developed a bomb. When there was a dialogue during the Clinton administration, North Korea was not going the bomb route. Then when Bush administration realized that they need to engage North Korea, again, North Korea came back to the six-party talks. It is a frustrating process, and it is not an easy solution, but you have to use pressure and incentives together.
And to those who would say that the time for dialogue and engagement is long past and that the only way to stop Iran would be through some kind of military intervention, you say what?
Well, I say that this is the way to Armageddon. You know, I say there is no military solution. And I'm not the only one who's saying that. Secretary Gates said that a couple of months ago, that maximum, if you use force, you will delay the Iranian program but for a couple of years, but then they will come back with a vengeance. You cannot bomb the knowledge. Iran could go easily underground. You will get every Iranian, even those who do not like the regime, rally around the regime policy. So this is where we are. I wish I have an easy solution for you, but all I know that we should not isolate Iran. We should not only use sanction. We should try to be creative. We should try to engage the entire international community in a way that make Iran turn around and understand that it will be in a much better position to integrate itself with the international community through a policy of transparency and constructive engagement.
I've been speaking with Mohammed El-Baradei, who stepped down in December as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Melissa.